Coffee Anthropology. Yes, there is such a thing, and this episode is all about it. Are you ready?
Your podcast with a little bit of Brazilian coffee. Café.
Hello, Coffee listeners! Here we have a special guest, and we are going to talk not only about coffee, but we are going to talk about coffee people. Some people might believe that coffee people are the best ones, and if this drink, this beverage is made by people for people, why not study about these people? Yes, people, it is time of social isolation, and the coffee industry is learning important lessons about businesses, about how we drink coffee, and most importantly, how can we use coffee to do some good in this world. Here in Brazil, I assure you, it's really weird to see my favorite coffee shops closed. Baristas, friends of mine, they are worried if they are going to have a payment in the next month, and producers are really concerned about next harvest. Yeah, the quarantine is extended to rural areas as well. The reality in the countryside is less tragic when compared to big cities such as Rio de Janeiro and São Paulo. But the concern is the same. How will we harvest all these coffees? These strange times, when everything changes daily, we just wish for the best. And we hope things will be functioning until June, the peak of our harvest season. I hope you guys are safe, having great coffee. Stay home, guys, because the coffee industry needs you healthy and smart. So take this extra time to study coffee. My tip is, why don't you go over coffee episodes in English and learn about Brazilian coffee. I can guarantee you that there are interesting stuff. And talking about Brazilian coffee, it's an honor to receive this important anthropologist. I like to call her as coffee anthropologist, Sabine Parrish. I met her in São Paulo, where she lived for 1 year studying coffee scene here in Brazil. This episode was recorded in the beginning of this year, 2020, and it was made via Skype. I was in São Paulo and she was in London. So you will notice a difference in the audio quality, but besides that, I guarantee you this episode is unmissable. So, here in Brazil, we have more than 132 years designed, dedicated to coffee science, but usually to productivity of the plant, new technologies, and control of plagues and diseases. And it's not common to find researchers who will study the human relations around coffee. That's why I invited Sabine Parrish. Welcome, Sabine.
Hello, thank you so much for the invitation. It's really, really nice to be back here, and a little less scary this time because we're talking in English.
Exactly. I have the luck to meet Sabine here in Brazil while she was performing a research about Brazilian coffee. And she speaks quite well Portuguese, guys. And I recorded her first time here at Coffee. It was in Portuguese. So if you want to practice your Portuguese and fall in love with her cute accent, so just give a try. I will leave the link in the website. So if you're listening in Spotify or any podcast app, just go to the website www.portalcoffee.com. So, yes, now it's my turn to be weird and awkward with my accent, Sabine.
Come on. It's going to be fine.
Before we start the real deal, would you be kind and introduce you, your studies, how you entered the coffee industry? Because it's not common to have anthropologists working in this industry.
Well, I mean, you were saying earlier that Brazil has such a great tradition of coffee science in terms of the chemistry and agronomy and everything. And I would have loved to do that, but it turns out I'm just kind of, I'm not very good with numbers and all of that, but I am very good at talking to people and just chatting and blabbing. And then I discovered that anthropology was a thing where you could just go around the world and talk to people and see what they do and ask them why they do it. And I was like, okay, I guess science is out and social science is in. So
why not?
That's sort of how that's more or less how I wound up here, you know, in the very condensed version. As you said, I'm an anthropologist of coffee, and people think that's a bit funny sometimes since anthropology is actually the study of humankind, but I work within a subfield of anthropology known as material anthropology. So we look at how humans interact with and influence and use different kinds of materials. And so I use coffee as my sort of starting point that brings people together. And then I look at people's practices around coffee. So that's it, really.
Oh my goodness. So coffee for you is just an excuse to study people.
Well, pretty much. But also, you know, I thought, well, I like drinking coffee. I'm going to keep drinking coffee. I want to be a researcher. You know, let's be honest, I'm kind of lazy. I just wrapped everything up into one thing.
So exactly.
If I'm going to do a PhD, I'm going to have to drink a lot of coffee to finish it. So might as well do the PhD about coffee.
And you were also a barista, right? To pay your university. How did you work?
Yeah, I started working as a barista in my last year of secondary school. So in 2007. So that was, I think, 111 years ago.
Oh my God. Guys, she's not even 30 and she's doing her PhD. I feel like she knew close to her.
Shut up. It's almost my birthday. I'm going to be 30 really soon. I did work stuff for a very long time. A very, very long time, it feels like. There's so many little barista babies that people are like, oh, yeah, I've been working in coffee since like 2015. I'm like, oh, my God. I'm so old in terms of coffee. Not actually, in a few months when it's my birthday, yes, then I can say I'm actually old. And then just very recently, I have sort of gotten back into baristaing because my husband and our best friend just opened a coffee shop.
So, where?
Found myself behind the bar again in Cardiff in Wales.
Good. And you did your master degrees, which was dedicated to coffee too. Can you just give a synopsis of this particular study and then we go to your PhD?
Yes, absolutely. So I did my master's degree here at the University of Oxford as well, also in anthropology. And I was looking at specialty coffee, but instead of in Brazil, I was working with baristas in the United States and looking at the intersection between sort of gender and economics in the workplace and how systems of tipped wages impacted women's career trajectories within specialty coffee. And part was focused on how that impacted women's ability to get to coffee competitions and then how they progressed once they were there. So I've done a fair bit of writing on this, subsequently published a sort of popular version of that research in Standart magazine a couple of years ago. And then I don't know when this podcast is coming out, but in April, the academic article based on which will be coming out. And I think it will not be behind a paywall. I think the journal does for 1 year, it will be open access, so it's available to the public. We don't need to talk about paywalls right now. I'm a big, big, big proponent of making academic work open access, but that's probably another argument for another day.
This first research, her master degree was subject here at Coffia, but in Portuguese. So if you guys study or learn a little bit about Portuguese, it's really worth it. If you don't, you can check this, let's say, popular version of her research at Standard Magazine in an article called She's a Lady. It's really, really nice. Thank you, Sabine, for doing that. It's something to read and to shake our concept and the power structure within this industry. But okay, this is another podcast that we can record in English. Let's talk about your PhD here in Brazil. Why Brazil? You spent 1 year here without speaking properly Portuguese. What were you looking for? What is the beginning? Okay, I'm going to look at Brazil now.
Hey, don't say I don't properly speak Portuguese. I know I have a really silly accent in Portuguese, but I speak just enough to not, you know, die.
Sorry,
No, the reason I was in Brazil was because, as I said earlier, I'm secretly very lazy, and I had studied Portuguese in my undergraduate degree. I did a degree in anthropology and Latin American studies. I specialized in Portuguese language instead of Spanish, just because I felt like it. Just to be different, everybody else signed up for Spanish.
Because Portuguese is awesome.
Yeah, and it's beautiful. I basically saw, 30 people signing up for the Spanish class, and I was like, oh, screw it, I'm going to the other one. So it was me and like six other people. So, yes, Brazil. I say that jokingly, that I just did it because, I already spoke Portuguese. I knew I wanted to study coffee. But in all honesty, Brazil sort of chose me. There was no question in my mind going into this project, which was centered around looking at coffee consumption in coffee producing nations, that there was no question, not even for a second, about where to be. It really only could have been Brazil. And even within Brazil, it was obvious, though there are other cities that have other merits. The entire city of Curitiba is mad at me for not doing my project there, but it had to be Sao Paulo also. That's a city just completely built from the economy of coffee. It is today the largest city in Latin America, the largest city in the Southern Hemisphere, and without coffee, it wouldn't be that way. So to do my project somewhere that was historically grounded and situated with such a wealth of coffee, it was always going to be Brazil. No question about it.
And what was your main interest, the focus of your research? Because I know that academic research, you need to be very clear your goal and your methods and your tools. So what did you have in mind when you packed and came here to spend 1 year?
Yeah, so I have read a lot of books, and you probably have too, and hopefully our listeners have books about coffee, and they will go at some point like this. They go, Brazil is the world's largest producer of coffee. Next sentence will be, Brazil also consumes a tremendous amount of coffee. Then they go back to talking about the production. Brazil has been relegated to, within our discussions within the coffee industry and even the specialty coffee, as only a producing nation. However, so Brazil, depending upon the metrics that you use, either has already in the last year or will by the end of next year surpass the United States as the world's largest single consumer of coffee. So I went in trying to understand what consumptuses are like in somewhere that has traditionally been conceived of only as a producing country.
Wonderful, yes. According to Euromonitor, we are already the biggest consumption market.
So secondary to that is, you could back me up on this, please tell everyone how it is in Brazil. There are a lot of infrastructural issues and restrictions in place that make it very, very, very difficult to get coffee that is not Brazilian coffee when you are in Brazil. So my anthropology department here, I'm right around the corner from a coffee shop, and I can go there. I went there this morning, and they had coffee from Costa Rica, from Rwanda, from Kenya, and from Colombia. So there were four coffees, tiny coffee shop. In Brazil, you go to any coffee shop and the coffees are all Brazilian. And within academic literature and even within our specialty coffee community, we really tend to think of coffee as this very globalized, possibly even the first sort of truly global commodity or product. In Brazil, you have a situation where you have a national product that's consumed only kind of within these national boundaries. So I wanted to look at what happens when the thing that's kind of, the sort of classic example of an exotic foodstuff has that layer of exoticism removed. And so that is mostly what I was doing.
It's wonderful you bring this up, because Brazil has some law limitations about importing green coffee. And some might say it's like biological security. Other people believe that it's just protecting the market. However, Brazil is huge, and we have more or less 31 different little origins, little terroirs where you're producing different coffees with different sensorial profiles, with the technology aging and fermentation, we can find very different profiles, sensory profiles. However, it's really difficult to get some coffee from Africa, Colombia, and a roasting master just developed their roasting profile here in Brazil. So all the international coffee that reaches Brazilian consumers came already roasted. So this is really how is a specialty for the Brazilian consumers, which is pretty different from consumers in Europe, for example.
Exactly. And that's one of the things that I saw very readily as being something that was quite, I thought, not very just, and something that's operating on kind of historic power structures that did actually come out of how colonial extractivist agricultural trade routes were set up. I mean, Brazil was a colony to provide raw agricultural goods for Europe. Period, full stop, end of story. Settlement was very much secondary in the sort of Brazilian process. And so you still get this situation where Brazil is providing these sorts of raw materials. Brazil is providing so much coffee for everybody else. And we are not really taking the time to turn around, to look and see, you know, what is happening in Brazil.
And because Brazil is so huge, you just narrow down to São Paulo City, where the specialty coffee scene is blowing.
Yes, and part of Brazil does have these, you know, 31 growing regions. There are a lot of flavors throughout Brazil. Outside of Brazil, people still kind of, oh, it's chocolate, it's nuts, it's whatever, it's Brazil, it's one thing. That's starting to change, but one thing I've noticed is that to be a good member of, you know, what we sort of call this global specialty coffee community, you have to have, you know, your own knowledge about flavors, and you have to have flavor points of reference. Otherwise, maybe you just like specialty coffee, but you're not, you know, you're not really seen as a real connoisseur or a serious member of this community. And that is really unfair on people like Brazilians, like other producing nations, which have similar rules to Brazil, because it's so difficult to get these other coffees, and it begins to sort of value and privilege different ways of interacting with specialty coffee over others. And so that's what really, really fascinated me about Brazil and drew me to Sao Paulo as this amazing, huge, diverse, cosmopolitan city, but one where you almost never see a non-Brazilian coffee.
Exactly. It's really rare, and when it happens, it's expensive.
It's really expensive. People are smuggling them in, which I just was so delighted when I realized. I was just over the moon. Everyone's like, oh, you're going to do research in South America. You know, I know people who work in like Ecuador, Bolivia, you know, they work with, you know, cocaine and this sort of smuggling. And I'm like, yes, coffee smuggling. Great.
Check it out. I am the ultimate badass. Yeah.
And it's funny because some coffee shops are even showing off. Ooh, we have today coffee from Panama, from Mexico, from Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. So it's like something that you even show off in your Instagram account.
Absolutely. But I mean, why wouldn't you? It's totally different from what's available day to day. And I think it then becomes very important for people who are in sort of the consuming path of Europe, the United States, Canada, Australia, who are kind of in this position of power where they can set trends and more better kind of say what's valued symbolically in specialty coffee right now, to realize that not everybody has the same access to all of the facets of specialty coffee that they do. So lastly, let's just come back to the fact that Brazil consumes coffee now than the United States, or maybe by the end of next year, you know, two different metrics. But okay, Brazil basically consumes more coffee than the United States at this moment. And that is increasingly and increasingly more and more specialty coffee. So why, you know, why are we still thinking of Brazil and Brazilian consumers as sort of something else, right? It's because you're also a producing country. You might be the center of the sort of free, but Brazil still winds up being on the periphery. And I think people need to stop and reassess that very quickly, because the global consumption landscape is going to change massively. It already is changing, and how we interact with and value coffees is going to change on a lot of different reasons that are, like, a lot of wonderful scientists are working on, you know, climate change and how that's going to also a social element as well. And people who previously didn't have access to the best coffees that were always earmarked for exportation out of their country are increasingly going to have the options to retain those and not necessarily let them enter the world market. Because why should you let your very best coffees go away? There's no necessary reason other than economics, but economics is not, you know, the end of, it's not the be all end all.
It's important you mention that because Vera Espíndola from the board of directors of SCA made a research. She came to Brazil too, pointing that maybe one of the solutions for the price crisis is producing countries start focusing in their domestic market. And it's what you are saying right now. I'll leave the link. She made a recall last April, and I'll leave the link in here. And we also recorded a podcast in English. I'll leave the link in the website.
Yeah, perfect.
Interesting. And then, okay, you arrived in Brazil as a researcher. You need to be very clear about your tools and methods. What were your first steps to do this research?
Right. So anthropology is, it's something I love, but other people can find very difficult in that it is such a discipline. And basically what I did was I just got an apartment through a friend of a friend of a friend. And it was kind of near a coffee shop. And I just started going to the coffee shop and I sat there and I drank some coffee and I came back the next day. And I just began to live a life in Sao Paulo. And that's all I did for about the first month. I just started looking at, you know, what was the daily flow of things within the coffee shops? Does it get busy after lunch or before lunch? Is there a rush when everybody gets off of work? I circulated about 25 coffee shops in Sao Paulo. I noted down, you know, made sketches of all of them, looked at where they kept sugar, keep sugar. I have a list of every coffee shop's menu, all of this. And so I just let the flow happen around me for about the first month and a half. Then I started to kind of go around and introduce myself to people. Started showing up at events. This is around the time where I got to know you. We met in August of that year, and I had arrived in the second half of June. So, and then from there, I began just kind of be part of the community as much as I can. And it's a difficult thing to be both part of a community and a researcher. It's, you know, ethically, there's all kinds of considerations to make sure that everybody you're interacting with knows that you're here as a researcher, but also to create space for yourself to have downtime. And, you know, you and I would go out sometimes and, you know, we'd just be having drinks and, like, someone might say something interesting about coffee, but screw it. Like, this is happy hour. You know, you need to make time for yourself as well.
Exactly.
That's definitely farther down on the list. It's not as important, but it's also important. And that's kind of what I did throughout the rest of the year. I just circulated the sort of all the coffee community events that I could go to. I worked in a couple of different coffee shops for a few days here and there in Sao Paulo. Spent a lot of time at Wolf, the coffee roastery in the north sort of area. Did a lot of work with Danilo Lodge, sort of teaching classes, just following him around like a, you know, sad little puppy dog. So just to make myself present, to be there. And our principal research method in anthropology is called participant observation. And it is exactly what it sounds like. You observe, you need to watch that flow go around you, but we're not lab. You know, the real world is the real world. We don't really concern ourselves with replicability. This sort of, can I, you know, get these exact same conditions and, you know, retest this hypothesis? No, because people aren't testable like that. We can only record what people are doing and how people are experiencing and what they are feeling to the best of our abilities in a given moment. And to make a record of what was happening among people loved and were excited by coffee during this 12-month period in 2018, you know? That's what I have to offer ultimately.
Did you have the opportunity to visit some coffee farms?
Yes, I did. God, I think I tallied it up recently. I think it was something 27 total over the year that I was there. Some of that was some of these kind of quick fire. Very, very fortunate because of my position as a writer for Standart magazine, I was fortunate enough to get to accompany the champions trip to Brazil with all the world coffee champions. So I got to meet up with them, but we went to so many farms so fast. But then also you and I, we got to go see a bunch of farms when we went to Cup of Excellence together.
Exactly.
And then I also just bounced around of different farms. I've spent quite a bit of time now, two separate visits out with the good folks at Deterra as well. And I wish I could just go live on the little house on the property.
Yes. It's like the coffee Disneyland.
Yeah. Oh my God. They give you so much food. I'd, you know, gain 10 kilos in a week if I actually stayed there. Yeah, and so my focus of this research was really on consumers. And so it's not, you know, it's not really focusing on the agronomy or anything.
Yes.
But part of that is thinking about, okay, well, how do consumers in Sao Paulo understand and think about where their coffee is grown? Even though it's, you know, it's not in Sao Paulo, it's not in the city, but it's much, much closer than, you know, it is for me here in Oxford to, you know, the Cerrado Mineiro.
Yeah.
Brazil. So looking at how people conceptualize if the commodity chain, when it's still there, it still exists, but it's much, much, much more condensed. It's much shorter.
You were born in America and then you were studying in England, Europe. Weren't you afraid to come with this colonization point of view? What were, especially with this language barrier, how were the challenges and what you were paying attention to avoid?
Absolutely. That's a really good and really important question, because especially as an anthropologist in Brazil, there's a really bad history with anthropologists from abroad coming in, particularly working with indigenous communities and really fucking shit up and being terrible people.
You are saying, I'm not saying.
I'm saying it. I completely cop to it. And my discipline, we have a lot of self-reflection to do. A lot of early anthropology was incredibly regressive, incredibly racist. It really, the early days of this discipline really thought this sort of cultural evolutionist standpoint that those are the primitive people and we are evolved over here.
Yes.
We want to see how Stone Age people. Terrible, awful. And every anthropologist who works today needs to reckon with this and take an ethical stance against this. This is obviously not how anthropology has been for a very long time, but one is required to be a conscientious practitioner, as one ought to be a conscientious practitioner of anything. So something really important that it seems like a small thing, but you brought up the language barrier. It is incredibly important to me to speak Portuguese when I'm in Brazil to the best of my abilities. And you know, I would get tired or I'd have three drinks or, you know, and I just get exhausted and I can't string together a sentence. But the onus is on me to integrate myself into your culture. Now, there were oftentimes people wanted to practice their English with me. And so, of course, I would facilitate that, but I would never expect anybody to have to speak English with me.
So that's
a small thing, makes it me more tiring, but why would I ever expect to go into Brazil and just think I could get away? No, it's a small thing, but you know, it's a moral orientation. It's the right thing to do. The other thing to do is we sometimes talk about it in terms of this idea of co-production. As in, I had some ideas and I had some questions. And then I went to Brazil. And it's important for me to run those ideas and questions by people and to ask, like, do you think I'm totally wrong? Is this question not relevant? Is there anything you feel is more urgent for us to look at? Is there something that you will get more value from? And in terms of that value exchange, the other thing that has not yet happened, but is also really important to me, and I know you and I have discussed this before, is I do not want my results only to stay in English. That's a very big problem within academia, where people go to communities, they do research, that research in English and in English only. And it also exists the other way when people are publishing in Portuguese or in Spanish, and they're only publishing in Portuguese and Spanish. And those amazing researchers and these amazing minds and these amazing, you know, scientists and social scientists, they're not necessarily getting heard or getting the recognition that they deserve because English has become the lingua franca within academia. So
thank you for that. Yes.
To publish in Portuguese. Now, I'm still writing up the doctoral thesis. That has to be in English, unfortunately. Once that's done, that is first on my list, is I need to begin to translate these results into Portuguese, but not just into Portuguese.
You're going to translate in other languages too?
Okay, so not just into Portuguese, but nobody wants to read a doctoral thesis. They're very, very, very boring things. Listeners, Kelly can verify this. I just sent her a chapter of my thesis. Nobody wants to read that. It's boring. It's long. It's a hard to read format because you have these citations and it needs to be. The point of that rant is basically, it is very important to me to publish both in Portuguese, but then also in Portuguese and in English to make sure that what I find is available in format hideously boring as academic articles or theses.
Thank you. To finish, to wrap it up, can you share some findings of your study after 12 months here in Brazil?
Yes. So one day I was walking through a supermarket, which is a favorite hobby of mine because I'm actually very boring, a supermarket in Sao Paulo. And I noticed that some of the coffees say coffee, tipo exportação, exportation type. And I was kind of like, wait,
what is that?
Yeah. What is this? Like, it's either exported or it's not. It's not exportation type, right? That was a category that I saw. It didn't really make sense to me. So what I did was I took that category to my participants, to people, and I said, hey, can you kind of explain to me what tipo exportação, what exportation type is? And then it turns out there's this whole amazing additional category. So we tend to think of you have a foreign good, right? Or you have a domestically produced good. But something that's tipo exportação, this idea of exportation type, is it's domestically produced, but then not exported and then used for internal consumption. I'm like, This is amazing because Brazil is this really dynamic hybrid producer consumer economy. That is what is so interesting about it right now. And then here with this idea of tipo exportação, we can see very much that dynamism and these, you know, hybrid forms of consumer goods in action. As you know, you can have tipo exportação in a more metaphoric sense, a football player from Brazil who's really, really good, you know, Neymar, before he
messed it up.
It just really, it's very reflective of this, you know, the way that consumption is beginning to hybridize with production. And I don't think it's necessarily unique to Brazil, but it is something very characteristic of places that have traditionally been agricultural production economies that are now moving into a state of economic development where they're actually able to say, we want some of that. You don't just get to have it, you know, United States or EU. You know, you're able to kind of say, well, that's exportation type, but we're going to keep it. And I think that's so amazing. So, yeah, I'm just in love with export to sell.
traditionally, we learned that the best coffee was leaving Brazil because international community was willing to pay more for those producers.
Absolutely.
Especially with the price crisis, coffee farms are looking with more carefully the domestic market. So some farms are 100% selling great coffee and their bad coffee to the domestic market to different consumers' profiles. The ones who want very specialty, which we call cheap exportation type, and the ones who are used to very bad, low quality, very bitter coffee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the, I mean, I've seen it even changing in just the last few years. You know, I've met many, you know, roasters or coffee shop owners within Brazil who they would get an amazing coffee 1 year from a producer in Brazil. But then as soon as that producer realized that, oh, well, the fancy coffee shops in Sao Paulo, they want this coffee. The next season, they know that their coffee is good enough that they can attract international buyers and they can sell that coffee for more to international buyers. Now, with the price crisis, this is changing. But I mean, why, you know, there's the, why should they not sell to whoever pays the highest, right? And exactly. So that creates a very difficult situation then for the Brazilian consumer essentially caught in the middle.
The title of your PhD is Market for Export, Post-Colonial Legacies, Value in Motion and Specialty Coffee in São Paulo, Brazil.
It's a mouthful.
Exactly. Summarizing this title, you recognize the exportation type, and what were your findings?
Yep. So this idea of exportation type, it grows out of how Brazil was set up as an agricultural colony, where things were extracted and taken elsewhere. And there are still lingering, you know, post-colonial legacies in terms of this kind of sense of inferiority that Brazilians have quite, you know, in sort of relation to their place in the world, is a very common thing that we see in a lot of former colonies. The idea of value in motion, let me just out myself here, that comes from Marx. It comes from Marx's idea of capital as value in motion. It needs to circulate in order to be created. And I take that and I look at sort of the symbolic value that we can create and then accrue through consuming specific kinds of coffee. But then I also look at who gets to decide what is valued and what is valuable. And so it really returns us to this idea of Brazil being essentially the center of the periphery in terms of the coffee world. Or there is another writer, Robert H. Bates. He's a political economist, and he's put forward this idea of Brazil as the supply side hegemon, in that Brazil is, you know, the top of all of the producing countries. Brazil can kind of bully around all the other producers, right? You know, Brazil's so big, you know, frost in Brazil or floods, you know, like have happened, that can change globally the price. Like, Brazil is really powerful. But ultimately, it's still, regarding coffee, a producer and therefore subservient to the demands and the economies of the importing countries. And so that kind of brings us back full circle to this international exchange of coffee. But coffee is what, you know, it's linking people. Coffee is exchange, you know, being exchanged internationally or just nationally within Brazil. But I don't ultimately care that much about the coffee. I care about people drinking it and trying to get the coffee that they want, or feeling mad that they can't get the coffee that they wanted, or it's too expensive. You know, that's what I care about and that's what I'm interested in. But coffee just gets us there.
It's interesting. It's important to mention that Brazil was colony of Portugal, and who really incentivated to have coffee trees here in Brazil was Dom Pedro II, the emperor. Mm-hmm. And he was the one who opened the scientific cells to research coffee productivity in Campinas, in Instituto Bioagronômico de Campinas, IAC, or IAC. And And Brazil was one of the last countries to stop slavery. So
yeah,
these facts are really important to understand the sense of inferiority, even though we are very powerful, productive, and we can shake the coffee world when flooding or drought come around. And this happened already.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm an anthropologist, I'm not a historian, but our disciplines speak a lot to each other, you know, and I think it's very important to, especially because as specialty coffee, we often operate on this kind of condensed timeline. I want this new coffee and I want it now. And, oh, we've just got this new crop in and it's going to sell out. And, you know, but it's been almost 200 years since Brazil became independent from Portugal. Yes. It's 1822, right? Yeah. And then, you know, 1888 until, you know, full abolition and emancipation in Brazil. These are very long timelines and we still see their effects in the present, you know? And so I just, yeah, it makes me, I'd like to encourage all of the specialty coffee industry to, you know, reflect on their practices and how they might have been influenced, but also how they will influence things down the line, even, you know, not intentionally.
And what do you see for us, Brazilian coffee professionals? What we can do to change this mindset here in the domestic market, this inferiority?
Oh my gosh, it's a really, really big question. And I am
doing my part. I'm recording podcasts in English and talking about this huge coffee producer.
You're doing an amazing thing. And I've already seen things, you know, changing in the last couple of years in terms of recognition of actually how the different regions in Brazil can really taste quite different. But the other thing is honestly, okay, if you're just dealing with Brazilian coffee, you get rid of the like international flavor wheel. It has a lot of flavors that are, can't find a fucking lemon, you know, almost anywhere in Brazil. It's not useful. Why don't we create a relevant flavor wheel that has amazing Brazilian references that you do find in these coffees, like Jabuticaba or, you know, who knows what, but you need to work with what we have and what we know and what's accessible, you know? And so lemons.
Different types of lemons.
Forget.
We have more than five.
Yeah, exactly. No, you have more than five kinds of limes.
Exactly.
Not lemons. No lemons. Very, very hard to find lemons, and they're very expensive. Okay, there's other fruits. Lemons just come to mind.
Brazilian consumers, they don't have much idea what is a blueberry or a fresh peach. We don't.
Yes. And so there are ways to make essentially locally intelligible. Now, we don't want that to shut people off from participating in the international market. No, but then we don't have to only use one flavor wheel. What if we could learn to use two? There's no reason to only use this one.
Thank you. This is for the Brazilians. Hey guys, let's think about it. Maybe producing a specific flavor wheel, it's important in other producing countries too, because when I went to Colombia, there were fruits that I never saw in my life.
Absolutely, you know, and we're all, you know, the poorer for not knowing these things and not having them as a reference. And yes, I mean, I think it's an idea that needs to be considered very carefully. It's my gut feeling that I think it would be a great thing, but you absolutely don't want to, you know, shut people off from an international market, because, you know, the case is going to be, well, okay, say Brazil takes up a flavor wheel that has Jabuticaba and Cupuaçu, that's not going to be taken up in Europe, right? So you don't want to be in a position where, you know, that makes that translation even harder. But, you know, if that's something useful for consumers and that gets them excited and it's something they understand and provides a bridge, then that's an amazing thing.
Exactly. To wrap it up now, our interview, thank you very much. Do you have any final considerations, especially for the international community? Because the way people are looking at the Brazilian coffee nowadays, it's much better. But nowadays, with all these preconceptions, it's all Brazilian coffee is good for blends and that's it. What kind of message would you like to share with this community?
I mean, there's good coffee everywhere and there's bad coffee everywhere. Just try it, you know? I've had terrible coffees from Panama. I've had terrible coffees from Ethiopia, but I've also had, you know, wonderful ones from Panama and Ethiopia and Brazil. So I think, you know, it really, really is changing, but I think we just need to cool it with some of the preconceived notions. And that should be, you know, cooled across the board, not just, you know, in relation to Brazil as an origin, but, you know, in terms of what we expect from service or many other areas of specialty coffee. You know, just don't take for granted what you think you know. Ask questions. Try to figure out why. Ask more questions, basically. That's my answer for everything. More
Let's
questions.
Talk, figure guys. Exactly. Let's talk.
Well, really, the job of the anthropologist is to be really just like an annoying little kid and just ask why. Why? But why? You know, but I think you should do that too.
Exactly. Thank you very much, guys. I will leave her email contact in the website for further information. She published already very good articles, not only at Standard Magazine, but academic ones, and we are going to share in our website. Thank you very much, Sabine.
Thank you. It was so nice talking to you.
Coffee, 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 co